Welcome to another episode of the Canadian Podcast. This is a special episode as we continue to bring you information and content that we saw at the Dairy Farmers of Canada's annual meeting in St. John's earlier this summer. Now, if you are a regular listener of the Canadian Podcast, you'll remember a few episodes back, we brought on Dr. Robert Tremblay. Dr. Tremblay is a vet who has been dealing with the issue of H5N1, or at least keeping an eye on that issue, as it's the avian influenza strain that's been found in dairy cattle in the U.S. Now, to date, we still haven't seen any cases in Canada, but obviously Dr. Tremblay is working hard at trying to bring information, trying to bring resources, and trying to bring a strategy to Canada to help make sure the industry is ready if we ever do find it. So, how about you take a listen? This is the conversation I had on stage with Dr. Tremblay from the DFC AGM. We did actually have a conversation, Rob, Sarah, you and I, a little while ago about just what HPAI was. And I think it's one of those things that we were discussing at lunch. Like, I don't know how many have followed it over the last little while. You reminded me that we are 4 months not even 4 months into how does HPAI impact the dairy industry? Something that, for me, I wasn't really all that worried about until now. And there's been a lot of evolution for it.
Sure.
So maybe we can kind of level the playing field a little bit for everyone. Give me an idea, Rob, in terms of what does... Yeah, shuffle closer. I don't bite.
Maybe we'll see.
We're feeding back through each other.
Give me an idea in terms of HPAI and its impact on dairy cattle. What does that impact look like? And how has it evolved in the last less than four months?
Yeah. So it was first identified March 25th of this year, and so we're not quite 4 months into it. It has certainly changed quite a lot, or our understanding of it really has changed quite a lot over that period of time. It was originally described in Texas, and now it affects at least 13 states in the U.S., including Michigan, which is pretty close to southern Ontario. No states that border Quebec at this point, but Michigan, Ohio, to the west, there are states that border the prairie provinces, so it's become quite close. HPAI stands for highly pathogenic avian influenza, in case anybody didn't know that. And that's the highly pathogenic is all based on how it affects birds, poultry, chickens in particular. So it's not highly pathogenic in cattle, but the descriptions are that it's reasonably devastating even to cow herds. It does not cause death the way that it does in poultry, but it causes usually mid-lactation cows, the highest producing cows, to be sick and very sick and to go down on their milk substantially. Their milk changes. It has a colostrum-like appearance. They will often have a fever, decreased intakes, decreased rumination. So they're sick. They're sick cows, and it takes them a while to recover. And so it's not inconsequential. In the United States, the stories of the reduced milk production represent quite a substantial economic loss to the herds that are affected. And it is the number of herds that are infected in the U.S. more or less increases on a regular basis. So it's spreading in the United States.
So as you mentioned, for those of us, you know, a lot will have heard what are, maybe you have chicken barns, maybe you've got neighbors with chicken barns, you know what the impact can be for them. It's maybe not quite that for the dairy industry, but at the same time, there's real impact if it arrives within Canada.
Yeah. I think there are two impacts. There's an impact not nationally because it just draws attention to the dairy industry that you don't really want, really. And then to the individual herds, there's the regulations in Canada is that you're required to report it if you see those signs. Your veterinarian will submit a sample to get a diagnosis. If the diagnosis is positive, then you will still be allowed to ship milk as long as you keep the milk from the cows that are ill out of the bulk tank, but you won't be allowed to move animals off your herd onto your declared negative, and you'll have to find a way to dispose of the milk from the infected cows, which is still under negotiation. So it's going to be quite a change in behavior, and in addition to the loss of income for the decreased sale of milk.
Yeah, something very, very much that we haven't necessarily felt as dairy farmers for a long time.
No, and the information from the U.S., it's not really real time, but it's being shared in a pretty current manner. And there are herds in the U.S. that had HPAI that are still not out of quarantine after several months. And so it's not a simple thing, I'll get this, get over it, and I'll be back to what I was before. We're not at the point of our understanding with this disease that we could say with certainty individual herds are going to be a month in quarantine or whatever. It's kind of open-ended at this point until you meet a certain set of criteria to show that you're free again.
Well, it is so new, and I think the science, you know, in the conversations that we've had over the last 3 months, it has evolved quite a bit. Can you give us an indication, what's the latest information really in terms of, like, how is this being transmitted, particularly from one herd to another? We don't have it in Canada, that's great. But how is a herd going to catch it in the first place? And how could, you know, if my next door neighbor has it, am I going to be really worried about that?
Well, and those are good questions. When this all started, we were focused on almost every way that it could be transmitted. So could it be cows? Could it be people? Could it be wild birds, et cetera? And we kind of settled down into a situation where lactating cows we thought represented the biggest risk of exposure.
And that through is milking equipment, wasn't it at the time?
Yes. This is a very unusual virus in that there is quite a lot of virus in milk, and interestingly enough, there's quite a lot of virus in urine as well. So that milk and all the process that goes on at milking, it's easy to envision that it would be spread through infectious milk. And so then if you kept these infected cows out of your herd, you know, you were judicious about that, maybe you could keep it out of your herd. Once it got into Michigan, it became pretty apparent that it was not just infected cows that were carrying it to other farms, that it was likely what we call fomites. So humans or trucks, trailers that were contaminated with urine and manure from infected cows going on to uninfected herds. So that's kind of the state of the world right now, is that started out with we were worried about everything, went through we were only worried about cows, and now we're back to being worried about cows and human traffic as the risk factors.
Which is the dairy industry. I mean, we're a pretty social group, I think. I know around our place, you know, there's people coming in and out of the office, you know, trying to either sell something or bring updates. And sure, we have some of these biosecurity things in place through ProAction. It's not the same as some of the other sectors when we think about poultry and swine. So can you give me an idea in terms of biosecurity? What do we as dairy producers need to really start thinking about today, and especially start thinking about if it does start to get closer or we start to see cases in Canada?
So this is a good time to not buy cows, particularly if you don't know a lot about where those cows come from. The CFIA, to their credit, they offer testing of cows, whether the cows have illness or not. So if you bought cows, it's probably worthwhile to get them tested. If you're moving cows around, or if you potentially have visitors that have been in the U.S. or in other dairy herds, probably wise to keep them away from your cows, to ideally keep them out of the barn, because you're not really sure whether they could be carrying it. This virus, although it's very sensitive, it's easily killed with pasteurization, for example. However, if it gets on manure and on boots, it can last for quite a long time. If it gets onto the floor mat of the pickup truck, it can last for a number of days. So people who weren't recently on a farm, for example, it could be transmitted by them unknowingly as well. So it's probably good to look at the biosecurity protocol for ProAction, and that's a pretty good guide. And then this proviso that if you're buying cows or if you're interacting with cows that might have originated in the United States, there's an extra level of concern that you have to have with that.
Mm-hmm. Then you mentioned that in terms of pasteurization killing the virus. Let's talk about that a little bit in terms of that, you know, consumer confidence. You know, the virus is in the milk. We know for certain that that virus is killed through pasteurization. We know milk will continue to be safe.
So that was an early question. And so people, the researchers conducted studies to show that pasteurization worked. But in every scientific study, there's a yes, but moment in it. And but the USDA did what is close to the definitive study, recently published it, that really mimicked what happens with commercial pasteurization. So it's pretty clear based on that study that commercial pasteurization, which is short time, high temperature, 72 degrees for 15 seconds, is 100% effective in neutralizing the virus. So that retail milk, even though you could find fragments of the dead virus in retail milk, it is not itself infectious. So there's not a public health concern. Anybody who consumes raw milk, though, there is worry about that.
Mm-hmm. So is that really the key message we need to be effectively starting to deliver now to consumers, that says pasteurization is really the key to the safety here?
Yep. I think that as each of these studies that has come out, the original study showed that pasteurization worked, and then there were some studies that sort of raised some questions, and now this most recent study pretty much conclusively has shown that commercial pasteurization is efficacious. They've been communicated. They're only communicated if you're listening in the right place, though. So it's a message I don't think that can be stated too often, that the research has pretty much shown that milk is safe, dairy products are safe, as long as they've been pasteurized at a commercial level. There are some research studies as well that show that if you're using on-farm pasteurizers, which typically are lower temperature for a longer time, that is efficacious as well. So 63 degrees for 30 minutes, for example, that works. As long as your pasteurizer is working properly, that works.
Yeah. Okay, so then let's back up to the case that we haven't seen it in Canada. That's great news. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't be keeping an eye out for it. What are we keeping an eye? You mentioned kind of that milk goes to that colostrum-like look. What other things should we be identifying? And if we have, or if a producer is calling, you know, their board member, you know, staff at their provincial association, you know, what's kind of the messaging to say this is what you've got to look for?
Yeah. Well, the first signs are kind of non-specific. So the cows are off feed. They may or may not have a fever. They look like sick cows. And then you start to see the changes in the milk. That generally occurs about 8 days after they're infected. And the abrupt fall in milk production and the change, the milk really does begin to look like colostrum again. The cows that are in mid-lactation and the highest producers, they're the ones that are most likely to be affected by it. So it should be dramatic. There are other signs too. So in the US, the early cases, there were dead birds on the dairy farm. And then cats, if they get this particular virus, have a very high probability of dying. So if you've got sick cats with neurologic disease, that's kind of another indicator that something could be going on in addition to having the signs in the cow. If you see that, you're obliged to call your veterinarian, who then will take a sample and send it off to get a diagnosis. It'll be a milk sample that they're sending off. Mm-hmm. And the cost of the testing the milk is covered by the federal government. This collection of the sample and so on is not.
That. I'm still going to get a bill from
Yeah,
that.
You're still going to get a bill.
They're
yeah.
good at sampling.
Oh, yeah.
So, okay, then in terms of, you know, this is going, there's obviously a lot of preparation happening in the background, a lot of research going on. Can you talk about the collaboration that's happening right now between, you know, kind of you, DFC, other national associations? We've got industry partners, whether they be, you know, genetics companies, you know, things like that. We've got our provincial associations. There's a lot of players in this
yep.
with a lot of moving parts. What's that collaboration look like right now, Rob?
It's how I spend most of my days lately. And but the Cheryl and I were principally, we work with the people in the federal government and then people at a provincial level, because everybody plays a role in trying to identify it soon when it comes and then be able to control it if it does come. I hope it doesn't come, to tell you the truth. But then it becomes, everyone is kind of bought in. So we're coming into show season, for example, and so we need probably to be aware that if you're having people move and cows move, et cetera, be aware that this might represent a risk. It's hard to know how much the risk would be, but if you're going to Dairy Expo or planning to go to Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin, for example, then you want to be hyper aware of what that risk might be and whether that's a good idea this year, for example. So there's all these players who are trying to come up with the best and most consistent message, given the fact that we're still not 4 months into this disease.
There's a lot still to learn.
Yeah, there's a lot still to learn. So some of it almost certainly will be wrong, but a lot of it will be right based on what we know now.
Mm-hmm. So I think you talk about kind of that show season coming up, whether it be, you know, with kids showing calves at fairs or whether it be some of the bigger events that are coming up. I think one of the dynamics we've talked about in the past about is just the difference between how the American dairy industry works in terms of there's lots of movement, right? Those heifers are moving around from facility to facility, state to state in a lot of cases before they're hitting some barns. Maybe not quite the same thing we have in Canada, but that movement does still exist in shows. Is there work going on in terms of like what is the rules that are coming, for some of these events that a lot of us are kind of preparing for now?
Well, so APHIS, which is part of the USDA, they've prepared guidance for the organizers of fairs in addition to those that are exhibiting there. And they are very conservative, including, you know, advising, do you really want to accept people in certain situations? All cows need to be tested going into the fair. There's a series of steps that could be taken to minimize the risk. And then at the fair, because there are a lot of the cows being exhibited are lactating, and if milk is the biggest concern, how to deal with that, how to protect the general public if milk could be infectious, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on in the fair exhibition space as well that really reflects the basic protective steps that any dairy would need to take. And it just that the stated purpose is the mixing of animals, so it just accentuates all the potential risk factors that would occur.
Mm-hmm. We've got about 5 minutes left, and I'd invite anybody, if you do have a question, come on to the mic. We've probably got about time for two. I'm going to ask you one question, though, before Albert takes over, and that's, you mentioned in the last session, salmonella kept you up at night. Does this?
I'm a lot older. I get up at night often now.
Albert.
Yeah, I know the feeling. Back in 2003, we had BSE, and we had one single cow in the West, or the Prairie provinces, that tested positive. A lot of us have suspicions that there were some south of the border, too, but they never found any of theirs. So, but why are we not? They closed the border to our cows very quickly. So now I'm thinking with fall incentives coming up, a lot of provinces have fall incentives to get some more milk in the system when our processors need it. I'm very concerned about these cows coming up from the U.S., mm-hmm. very concerned. So I'm just wondering, why has our government not moved on that? Like that we just, you know, it's one thing if we're sending call cows to be butchered there, like, but anything that's coming into Canada that could affect our milk supply, I just don't know why that's even going to be allowed.
So although I shouldn't answer it, I will.
Okay.
And
don't write this down.
But the difference between BSE and foot and mouth and a whole bunch of, and HPAI in poultry, is that HPAI in dairy does not meet that international standard that those diseases did. And so what the federal government does then is situational based on risk. So they can't close the border because this disease does not justify it. However, they can put conditions on animals coming in. And so there are conditions. The animals have to be tested before they can come in. They have to be have a certification they've been free of disease, and they're not from a herd that had disease as well. So they're, I think they're doing what they can. There's a lot of personal responsibility right now, with the understanding when you order 15 heifers, you don't really know exactly where they're coming from when they arrive. And so there has to be then some sort of on-farm isolation, et cetera, to protect your herd. You'll still need to do that, even if they were tested when they're coming across.
Last question?
Yeah, I think it is even closed to lactating animals, if I'm not wrong. State to state, they can't even move.
Yeah, so the only testing that's required by the CFIA right now is on milk from lactating animals. Yeah.
So now, let's say we get this.
Yeah.
What do we do? What's our treatment protocol for the cows?
When I did the podcast, this guy here, he asked me that tough question at the end of the podcast too. And sort of, I'm getting over it, but not a lot. And if we get it, then the game will switch from keeping it out of the country to keeping it off your farm. And so a lot of the biosecurity that sort of we've talked about now, it will kick in. But it'll have greater urgency because now it will be in the country.
More of like a treatment for cows.
So the treatment is symptomatic. It's a virus disease, so we're not going to do silly things like treat them with an antibiotic. It's supportive. They get dehydrated. They're not happy cows, and so it's supportive, which sucks the life out of your day. It just does, and so there's a big consequence to that. The death losses are not high based on the experience in the United States. However, the big question is, do these high-producing mid-lactation cows come back to their milk game? And how long are you prepared to wait to see that happen? So it's not going to be a lot of fun. The query that I always get asked, because I've been in vaccine development for a long time, is, are we going to have a vaccine for that? And this is going to be very political, because the HPAI in poultry is a reportable disease. And so with depopulation of farms and so on, so the decision to use vaccines in cattle is going to be quite a substantial decision to make.
So lots of electrolytes.
Yeah, so they get dehydrated. So hypertonic saline for the most severe cases, being pumped with fluids, is going to be. Anti-inflammatories are always good, makes you feel better. Joy juice, and then treating kind of secondary problems that they might get in, and just TLC. You can imagine if you've got the flu, hopefully you have somebody that will bring you something to drink and put a cold towel on your forehead, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it'll be TLC, which is time, right? That is a space to do it and time to do it.
With that, how about we give Rob a round of applause, everybody?
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Great to see you again.
Meet a Canadian dairy farmer. Planting one tree, then hundreds more. To naturally purify the air. Preserving wildflowers for pollinators. And nurturing wetlands for healthier soil. So wildlife can prosper.
Biodiversity is in our nature.
Working towards a sustainable future. That's Dairy Farming Forward.
We're in!
Well, a big thanks to Dr. Tremblay for joining the DFC AGM, and we hope you enjoyed the conversation that Dr. Tremblay and I had at that meeting, along with some of the questions from producers. Now, it is one of those things that DFC is continuing to send regular updates and regular information through to producers and the industry at large. It's one of those things that you'll want to check out the website. There are emails going out to producers as well to ensure that everyone is as up-to-date as possible as the situation continues to evolve in the United States. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. A big thanks to the production team, Carl Bellanger and Bruce Sargent. Of course, a big thanks to my co-host, Sarah Sash. We'll see you next time.